Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 19 with Paul Hendricks of Stall Hendricks, recorded at his home in Kessel in the Netherlands. Paul is someone who has a great insight into the sport horse world. He's been a successful dealer for over 40 years, which has included selling numerous horses that have gone on to compete at the Olympic Games. In addition to this, he and his family run the Dutch Sport Horse Sales and the Limburg Foal Auction. He's a breeder and has been for the past 20 years, and in addition to the foals that he breeds, he also buys a considerable number of foals in his area, throughout the Netherlands, and further afield. Together, the family run the show Peel and Mass at their base in Kessel. Stall Hendricks also have a breeding stallion element to their business. And if all this wasn't enough, Stall Hendricks were also one of the founding members of the very impressive and successful Peelbergen Equestrian Centre. And that's something that you will see throughout our conversation is a lot of the things that the Hendricks family have gotten involved in over the past 40 years always seem to have an element of strengthening and supporting the local area. And on the evening that we recorded this conversation, driving around with Paul Hendricks and his daughter Janu, that was something that was quite inspiring. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. I certainly did. In 2013, you spoke at a conference in Ireland.
Is that right? That long ago?
At the National Equine Conference. And you told a very interesting story, or a story that got my attention, that when you were young and you were finishing school, as a gift, your parents were going to get you a present. And of all the things that you could have chosen, you chose tickets to the Dublin Horse Show. You went on then to mention that that visit inspired you to be successful in horses. What was it about that visit or that experience that inspired you?
I was overwhelmed, first of all, how big Dublin Horse Show was, what it meant to the country, you know, the number of horses. But what I was also impressed by was what was possible with horses. I saw all kinds of people from all parts of the world coming to Ireland to buy jumpers, because there may be also some fox hunters, but in general jumpers. I saw it for the first time Arabic people with these white dresses buying jumpers. And it told me one thing, if you be able to create very good horses, you can get these people also to Holland. And that was my big inspirement from that trip. And other than that, the sport and the social life was fantastic in Dublin. And I couldn't get a better gift. You know, it did a lot with me. It did a lot of me. For sure, after that, I knew there was the road to success. And you know, the key word with everything you do in life is, and you have some people who can talk better than the others. But at the end of the day, it's the horse who makes you famous or not. So you have to make sure that you have the best horses as possible. And that's what I understood early in my life. And you know, I had a desire and I started to scout and I started to build up this family business together with my parents and later with my brother and later with my children. And but you have a good memory for sure. Dublin Horse Show was a very important moment in my life to recognize that.
But even to ask your parents for that, it wasn't that they experienced it and decided for you. You decided that that's what you wanted. What did you know about the Dublin Horse Show that made you want that as your gift?
I was aware that Ireland had the best jumpers at the time. I looked to Manginelli with Ambassador, you know, Given the name, all these good horses I saw coming by. So it for sure had my interest. There was a magazine in Holland who made also a big report of the Dublin Horse Show. Okay. So that definitely got my interest. And you know, even then in Holland, when people were looking for a better jumper, they would go to Ireland. The upper class people, they would go to Ireland to buy the better horses. So I know for sure I had to be there where the better horses were.
And at that time, when you went there and you experienced that, had you a clear idea of, or a vision of, what you wanted to create or what you wanted to achieve in the industry at that age?
Yeah, I was quite early in my life. I realized which direction I wanted to go. I wanted to be a successful horse trader, and later the breeding part came, I have to say, you know, but first of all it was to be successful in horses. And my father was tough to me, and Emil, who was my brother, and is my brother and is still my business partner, was the better rider of the two of us. There was no discussion, you know, that was easy. And my father thought, he said to me, "Paul, you have to be a very good rider to be successful in this business." And that even probably inspired me more to be successful, because I want to show off that it was possible also if you had not the love, talent, but if you had the drive to do it. And I believe in still in drive is the most important thing in somebody's success, or yes or no. Yeah, if you're a rider or a breeder or a trader. And for sure, I knew I was, my plan was to be a respectful and a good horse trader. Yeah, that was my goal.
So when you actually started to give it a go in the trading, what age were you doing that? And what was the moment where you had your first, we call it, big break, or the moment that you knew, I can live from this?
You know, you have to see, I'm born in 58, 18 school, 76, when we bought the first farm. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of export coming at these days. You know, Switzerland was coming to Holland to buy horses, because there was a lot of competition in Ireland to buy these horses. So some Swiss came to Holland. And you should see, you smelled that the export was coming. But it wasn't the beginning of it. My father, he was a good entrepreneur, and he saw also the future was coming, and you know, he saw a bright future for horses, and so that's why he bought the farm. We passed it, where Emil and Tim are living. And then when he couldn't talk it away from me that my plan was to be successful in horses, he sent me to a guy in the north of Netherlands, actually in the east north, called Gerard Heerding, who was a fantastic guy. He was like a second father for me. And he was a business partner of my father. My father, when he went up north, where in that part, in these days, there were the better horses. And my father bought a lot of horses from him. And he said, "Gerard, I can't talk it away of his head, but my son wants to be a horse dealer. And if, then he has to learn it with you. So can he come?" And I went there. And you know, I had the best experiments in life to be a horse trader, dealer, how you call it. I learned it all there. And in these days, there was a thoroughbred in Holland, Lucky Boy.
Yeah.
And he was very, you know, we had these old-fashioned Dutch mares. And he was, in the combination, he was a fantastic producer. And the guy gave me enormous freedom, enormous. He had two daughters who were not interested in horses. They were younger than me, and probably had good faith in me. He gave me enormous freedom. And then on one point, I saw a horse on a horse show, was called Van Gogh. And Willy Mellinger later was a European champion with it. And, you know, that was one of the first horses I discovered in my life. And, you know, then I get, yeah, how should I say, the desire to discover more. Yeah. I discovered also a horse called Mr. Ecke. Yeah. And, you know, the guy had enormous clientele, and he let me do it and do these deals. And, you know, it was enormous privilege to be in a place like that. And the guy had an eye for horse. I never saw somebody in my life who had a better eye for a horse. And I learned a lot of them about conformation, about how to look at a horse. And also, yeah, he never kept a horse. He sold everything, you know. He kept several horses maybe for 1 or 2 years to do sport, and then they were on the market again. So, fantastic. I was there for 2 years. And then he offered me to take over the place. And you said it earlier that you went back to your home after you had to make a decision. And for me then, I thought it was a challenge to work together with Emil, my brother, who was successful in the sport at the time. And, you know, I said, no, Gerard, I think I go down south and I go and start together with my brother. And yeah, that's how it all started. And you know, Emil did these horse shows, and I did the scouting from 18 on, maybe from 16 on. I had not even a driver license. And yeah, you know, we went to these local shows. We saw horses on the shows, and actually, I was maybe one of the first who started to buy on these horse shows because you know, you could go to places private. But I always thought, you know, the goal where I sell these horses is to do sport. So I better can buy them where they start with the sport. And that was the local shows.
And you mentioned your brother, Emil, and I guess if we look back now, you've been working together for 35 years, 30, somewhere around that?
No more, 45.
It's not always easy to get on with family. Well, what's amazing here is that there are so many of you involved. Yourself, Emil, you both have sons that are riding. Your daughter Janu is involved here. In what ways do you think yourself and Emil complement each other?
Oh, the compliment is that we are so different. So we strike it all, you know. Like he had me scouting. I never forget, you know. He would go to Calgary when he was young, and you know, at the evenings when we talked after the show, or you know, for him in the morning, and he would say, I think I'm going to bring some Canadians home with me, you know, who want to buy horses, and they need this and that and that. So he knew I was at home and I could find these horses or call for these horses. That's how we met Ian Miller. Emil was riding in Spruce Meadows, and he Ian Miller was never buying in Holland. He bought first in Ireland, then in Belgium, and then you know, he came to Holland and we sold him Big Ben. That was actually his first trip with us. And you know, that connection, you know, Emil doing the sport, me taking care about the home base, that was our accomplishment, that we be successful together.
That's super. And I suppose you could both be doing the thing that the other person didn't have the time.
Or didn't like as much. You know, our biggest fights, and I should not call it fights, were
discussions
when I was home when I was young, and he put on the board 6 horses for me and to ride. And I said, no, I only ride 2 because I have to go there and there to see a horse. And he said, no, you should ride 6. And no, I said, put me on the board for 2, you know. And he would have, you know, you would not pleasure him with having 2 horses to ride. He would prefer to ride 8 a day, you know, like, you know, he was a rider. So, no, that went very good. That went very good together. Yeah.
That was great motivation to make the dealing work so that you wouldn't have to ride 6 horses.
Yeah, no, exactly. but dealing, no, that, you know, our goal was to be successful at, you know, also what helped. And I didn't mention it earlier, was we living an hour away from Aachen. And actually, my grandfather, from my mother's side, he lived 10 minutes away from the show in Aachen, in Holland. And you know, as a kid, we went to Aachen. You know, you saw the world coming out for horses. You saw the best of horses. You know, that was dreamland. And you know, Emil and I said, you know, our goal is to be in Aachen once in our life, you know, with the team and be a member of the team. Now, Emil, I don't know how many times he rode Aachen, probably more than 10 times. And I tell you, when my son Michel was at the team in Aachen and he rode in Aachen, and I tell you what happened, I never forget it, was on a Thursday, he wrote Don Diablo. It was a home bred with my son. I tell you, that was a goose fever, you know, for a father to have your son with a home bred horse in Aachen. And, you know, Aachen was very important, that inspired people. I think a lot of people in this area were inspired by Aachen, dressage and jumping.
That's an incredible, it's an incredible opportunity to be exposed to somewhere so iconic, somewhere so influential at a young age. You know, and it's something even in the last interview that I did, it was actually one of the challenges that we were discussing. We're very lucky to have the Dublin Horse Show, and it's an incredible event, but our opportunity is once a year. So it takes a lot of effort to go to get exposed to something greater, but when you can have your grandfather 10 minutes from Aachen, it's an incredible motivation.
It's incredible, incredible. And I tell you, you know, I think the same like you. What happened if I was born near Stockholm? You know, what would be my, you know, what would be my affection to horses? Definitely it wasn't the genes. My father did it, my grandfather did it. So, yeah, it wasn't the genes horse, but so close to, yeah, the heart of the world that is Aachen is. Yeah. But, you know, from the other hand, I was looking for it, you know. Mm-hmm. That's why I went to Dublin. I give you an example. I was 23 years old of age, and Emil was riding the Europeans in 81 in Munich. Emil was riding on the tour quite a bit, and he met some Mexican people. And one of these Mexicans gave our address to an American guy. And this American guy wrote a letter to us. And Emil and I, on one day, we were writing a letter back to this American guy, but it had to be in English. And, you know, for a Dutch man on that age, it was not easy to write it. And actually, the guy put also a phone number on it. And I said to Emil, you know why we call him? That makes it easier. And, you know, we communicate easier on the phone than on the letter, because you have to send the letter, wait again till you get it back. So, lucky enough, we got the guy on the phone. We had no idea about the time difference, probably whatever, but we got him on the phone. And he came in 81. And there was a guy called Larry Mayfield. I still do business with his daughter. He passed away several years ago, but he was a great guy. And he was our first American contact in 81. And he came and he had a customer with him, and, you know, we looked at horses, it was a fun time. And I remember on Sunday, I asked him, you know, in a nice way, you mind if we go home to watch Stalin? My brother is riding the finals of the Europeans. And he said, of course. And Emil became fourth. It was a big thing then, these years, for a Dutchman to be on the European soil. Long story short, we did business with Larry, and he picked out three horses. But, you know, he liked a lot of horses. And he explained to us about the American market. He was living in California. And, you know, then I said, you know what, Larry? I put six more on the plate. I had no idea how many horses could be on the plate, but probably I called around and I found out. I put six more on the plate, and I fly behind the horses. So I flew in October, I never forget, I flew to LA, to San Francisco, and I stayed for 10 days in America, and when I came back I had all six horses sold as well. And that was the start, you know, and you know, it was in the genes, you know, that I want to be coming forward, and I want to be, you know, yeah, sell horses. And selling horses, my father said it always in a funny way, is try to make people happy, because it's their hobby. Yeah. 99% we sell to is people's hobby. And if you can fill in that dream, you know, what more you can ask for.
Yeah. And then that was 81, you said. And then so 41 years later, now 90% of your business is to the US. Is that correct?
You know what? Larry's girlfriend then, later his wife, was here this summer, and last summer, and, you know, we were having dinner, and I said, you know, it's 40 years ago when we met each other for the first time, exactly now, and Oh, it was during the auction. She bought a horse in the auction. It was during the auction. And I said to her, you know, this is 40 years that we are together in business. And that was remarkable. And still in business with the same people. That's fantastic.
That in itself tells a lot.
Though. Yeah, that tells a lot.
Yeah, on both sides.
On both sides.
Yeah. In those 40 years of dealing or trading, what do you think have been the biggest changes for you in your business? Or the biggest changes that you're seeing, be it good or bad?
You know, a good horse is a good horse. Reliability became more important. The veterinarian part sometimes gets a little bit ridiculous. It's not always a positive part. I think people overvalue x-rays on a horse. You know, I think it's a small part of a horse, of the whole soundness of the horse. Horses got better. We get better breeding programs, you know. When I started 40 years ago, I had to go all around the country to see a nice horse who had a nice jump. Nowadays, you hardly see a bad horse anymore. So the positive is we really try to get better. All of us, we breed way better horses than we did then. Competition is bigger, but I don't see that as a negative thing, because that keeps you active and that keeps you sharp. The horses became more expensive. That's not a negative thing either, because you can make more money if you have a good horse. Maybe it's not as relaxed as it was 40 years ago or 30 years ago, but that's probably, I should not blame that on the horse business. I think that's with everything in life, you know.
And when you say relaxed, in what way?
You know, people had more time for each other, you know, like horses had a break. But now I start to sound old-fashioned and I don't want that, but you know, we had our last show in December. It was a big show in the north of Holland, Zuid-Laren. And then, you know, the horses had a break till March. And then Zevtekenbosch came up, and there was a national show before. And then we went slowly to the spring. But now, you know, it's all year round. It's all year round, you know. If you don't go on the side of the world of show jumping, but every week there are 8-9 shows. Emil said it good the other day. He was directing manager of San Partigiano, and I don't know how many years ago, but it's not that long ago, there were only a couple 5-star shows in Europe at the time, in a year, other than the Nations Cup. And now I think for this year calendar, I don't know how many 5-star shows. It's tougher on the horses, yeah. And I think that's what we underestimate. Is that a good word?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know how tough you know, this calendar is on the horses and on the people who want to stay up in these rankings and things like that. You know, in the old days, it was easier. Like Emil Hendricks. But a lot of these guys, they were gentleman riders. And I mean with gentleman riders, they were not better persons than they are now. But you know, they had 1-2 shows in the month. You know, they prepared the horses for them, you know, and then they had 2 easy weeks. And then, but I see these guys now, Michael van der Vleut and all these guys, they live out of the suitcase, you know, they go from one show to the other. It's
intense.
It's very intense. That's very intense. And okay, I'm now on the age of 63, and then, you know, if you ask me what you prefer, this or back then, you know, the old days, that way they were nice.
Okay.
For people and horses.
You mentioned just your point about the x-rays and your feelings on that. I saw it in an interview somewhere where if you have a horse that you believe in and it has some commons, you have maybe a different way. You don't just throw it away. You have a different way of approaching it.
Yeah, no, first of all, and that's what I try to explain people as well who buy horses with me. First, I look at the athlete. And secondly, then clinical part. But, you know, that you see already by the athlete. Is he light-footed? Is he heavy-footed? How does he jump? You know, does the jump cost him a lot of effort, or is it a light thing for him to do? And then the X-rays are the third part. And, you know, you like... X-rays, you like to read the future of a horse. But it's so many times different than these X-rays that believe you. And that's what I've learned over 40 years. And don't think I don't make X-rays. Every horse here gets X-rayed by the age of 3. And we follow them. But if every horse with a single... difference or comment on the X-rays, if I would throw it away, I would have been bankrupt by now. And thank God that I kept some, and I developed them well, and they became very good success horses. The other day, it's a horse my daughter rode. It was a heartbreaker horse, and Eric van der Vleuten walked in here, and he saw the picture of the horse, and he said, that's a heartbreaker I had with Emil. And Genoux was riding it later. It was not a big time horse, but it was a nice 140 horse. And yeah, I said, remember it failed 3-4 times the vet? And I don't know, it was small things. And Genoux just got a text from the girl, the horse is 21 and still doing his job. You know, and that's what I mean.
That's what matters.
And that's what matters, exactly.
But you, in the piece that I read before, you do a lease agreement, is it? Sometimes if there's a question...
No, you know, I'm so lucky person to walk into a guy like as Emil Spadone in America. And he is our biggest representative in the States. And we have a lot of horses with him together and on stock there to be sold. And he's we do a lot of lease contacts with the horses. And a lot of leases comes... first of people who don't like a lot of these American fathers and mothers, they don't want to be part of selling a horse when the daughter decides it has to go to a university or she's not able to ride anymore, she'd like to give it back. And that's a part of leasing. The other part of leasing is if we believe in a horse but it has an X-ray remodeling or something where a vet not can live with, then we say, you know, we better do it in a lease. You know, and we even give the lease certain guarantees so they can ride. And after a year, they still can do a buyout if they think the horse is a match for life or not. And, you know, that gives us a bigger market for these horses with a comment on the X-rays. Yeah. And that's important because not every horse is good on X-ray. Especially, we want all these nice, good horses. And when you find a nice, good horse, you don't let them walk away on an X-ray. Some people do, but I not.
And that way, it feels like a fair way because you're sharing the risk with the person. So if you believe in it, you're proving you believe in it because you're willing to take the horse back.
Oh, that's with everything, you know. You should share the risk. And if you have good people where you work with, you know you're willing that. And like you say, you have long-time relations. And then you say to people, hey, listen, this is the problem, but I think we can handle it. But we started slowly, and then the lease is the perfect start, you know.
What I thought was interesting then, you mentioned it at the start, the breeding came later for a few different reasons, but at the start of your breeding program, you weren't just starting breeding with the mares that you couldn't sell here. You were actually doing the opposite. You went and bought back a lot of the good mares from America and started with a lot of those top mares that had jumped all the way up to the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
I suppose at the time, now everybody wants the mares that have jumped in the sport, but back then in maybe the early 80s, I wasn't born in the early 80s, but my feeling is that people weren't going to that effort. You were bringing them back from America.
No, but it was also later that I started it. You know, I had horses who jumped in the 90s, very good there. You know, but I saw, and one of my best friends was forever with Mr. Melchior, Willy van der Ham. And I followed that breeding part. And I saw there what was going well and what was not going well, you know. And in the beginning there, they did some routes who didn't work, and they did some routes who worked. And, you know, I had to learn from the mistakes they made, and I should not make these mistakes again. But I made them also, you know. I also started with mares who had not enough quality, and, you know, but that lesson was learned fast. And then I thought I buy these older mares back from the States. I bring them back because I had, I had a possibility to get them back. But that was not my biggest success. And I don't know if I told you that before, but it was not my biggest success. A lot of these mares, they give so much that they probably didn't give as much later as a brood mare. There were exceptions. But I still think, and now I come to a very critical point, that I believe in the best young mares give the best horses. And you know, that's proven in the Sawbreds.
That's what I was going to ask, because I think that's another thing that you mentioned at that conference, that that's something that you heard from the Thoroughbred people.
Yeah. And you know, I heard it from the Sawbred people, but it's proven, and you as Irish should know better than me, because you come from a country where racing is very popular. I think if I say it correctly, and you should correct me if it is not correct, the second, third, and fourth fold and the Sawbreds are the best winners.
There have been some of the theories is that the majority of winners come from the first three or first four folds of the winners, and I'm sure people listening, that'll create a lot of debate and discussion. But myself and a friend John Kerr, at one point we actually looked a few years ago. We looked back through the past 20 years of World Championships, European Championships, Olympics, World Cup Finals, 7-year-olds in Lanarkin. You know, any medal winners at championships, and a very high percentage were born with the first three or four in the sport horse industry too.
No, it's for sure. I think that it is like it is, like you say and like I say, but you know, we not all the World Cup winners or horses who go to the Olympics. You know, I had also out of old mares, I had good horses, and they jump up to Grand Prix level. So it's not said that it is not, but a fact is for sure that the young producers are the best brood mares.
Because am I correct in thinking that Bailey's, that Michelle would have jumped, and I think he jumped at the Nations Cup in Dublin, is that a grandchild of Liberty? It's out of Liberty's family.
Yeah, that's a grandchild of Liberty, but there were several Grand Prix horses out of that line. But Bailey's was, the mother was Come On, and I think Come On Nimmerdor, Come On Libero Nimmerdor.
Yeah.
And I think it was a full sister of...
Of Liberty.
Of Liberty.
Oh, okay.
But you know, and there you get back. There are certain lines who give the good horses, but it's not like that you can put the clock on it.
Yeah.
It comes by waves and it goes by waves, but there are certain damn lines, and that's where you have to look for as a breeder. And for sure, commercial, if you go to a foal auction, you like to have black type. But I like the good damn line. I see it now. You know, I had this success on the Stallion Show, and you the day after here, I had a fantastic 3-year-old stallion by Cape Coral, Cardanto, first foal from the Cardanto, Coriano. The mother had a 170 horse, a 160 horse, another 160 horse, a 155 horse, the Coriano. And that line I started 30 years ago. And I bought the mother, it was a Rigoletto Farmer. And back then, you know, you couldn't find not this much successful international horses. Yeah. But that was one of my first brood mares I started with, and it was very good pedigree. Rigoletto was Ramses, who made only jumpers, and Farn was a Holsteiner, you left as well. But the Farn mother had a full sister, and in combination with Rigoletto, she brought Queen of Diamonds. And Queen of Diamonds at the time with Jean-Claude van Geenbergen was a 15 three-hands big mare, who won the Grand Prix of Rome, won at Gothenburg, you know, was one of the best horses at the time on the international circuit. So that's why I bought that mare. That mare was founded after the first horse show she did. And the guy advertised her, and she was 3-4 hours away from me in Holland, that's far. And the guy said on the phone, yeah, but you have to be sure she's not a great mover. She foundered once, but she moves fine, he said, but you cannot use her for sport. And I sent my father up that day to pick her up, and you know, I bought a sister and I bought something else. But that family, that was the basic of my breeding, mm-hmm. you know, and there was a thought behind it. You know, it's not that I have every year a world champion out of that dam line, but you know, it always comes back on certain dam lines. That's in Holstein, that's in Hanover, that's at Schokkemüller, that's everywhere the same. Same in Ireland. There's always a connection with the dam line that you say, yeah, that grandmother or that second dam or that third dam also gave good horses, and then it comes back. But it is not like in line. That never will happen.
With the younger mares, you were saying that a lot of the time the good horses are coming from the younger mares, and that leads me on to both your breeding program, but your assessment and your selection of young horses. We saw,
by the way, before you go any further, you know, I always like the people to remember, you know, it's not written in stone, huh, that younger mares give better horses, but we all sing that and it's proven. I love that movie from that stallion, Secretariat.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And there was that movie, and there was a lady who could have 2 coverings by the father. And the stallion owner had the first choice. And the stallion owner came, and there were 2 on the ground. And he bought the one from the younger mare, because for the reason he wanted the younger mare. So the farm, who had the 2 mares bred to the stallion, they kept the foal from the older mare. And that became Secretariat, you know, one of the best racehorses ever in America. So that tells you it's not always a guarantee.
Yeah. Moving on to your breeding program, we took a walk through the yearlings there earlier, and you talked a bit about your selection process. I think there's some interesting things there, both in terms of how you select and what you see, but also leading on to how you select and breed your young mares as well. Just for those who maybe don't know about your breeding program or haven't heard this, will you talk through some of the numbers, how many you breed, how many then you bring in from your agreements with local breeders, and then maybe roughly how many you buy, and then the different stages that you assess them at?
I breed, I promised my wife, because she's a big help in my whole operation, that we're not only going to use more than 30 mares, that means 30 foals on the ground. There can be 25 one year, and there can be 30. So around that number, we breed ourselves. Then I have 30, 40 people I have a commitment with. They have probably mares that they got through me for several reasons. You know, I found them, or they came back from the sport. And I buy them every year, good or bad, what you can say from a foal, but good or bad, mm-hmm. the genes are good, and they use stallions, they talk it over with me. It could be my stallion, but it could be also another stallion, what we think is popular or would be the right match. So then you're up to 60, 70 foals, and then in the free market we buy 20, 30 foals. That means we go to auctions, but we like to stay close home, because I always say, how closer you are, how better you know the dam line. You know, that can be also 3-4 hours up north. You
and
know
the cellar.
So, and the cellar, that's also important. But you know, but I like to stay in Holland because I know the dam line so well. And you know, not every dam line, every leaf is super. You know, there are some leaves are a little weaker than the other.
Yeah.
But you like to know the strong.
The good branches, yeah.
Yeah, the good branches. And, you know, that's what we do. We start with approx 100. And then we start to jump them loose as yearlings. As I told you earlier, We do it in April, March, April, and we before May, when they be able to go to the fields. We like to be finished, and we do every group, we leave them in for a week. We jump them 3-4 times. We make notes every time. I start with confirmation from the foal. I start with the movement of the foal. And I do the writings. I don't do 6 out of 7 or 5 out of 7. I write down, you know, like a little bit heavy on the ground, you know, or can't not sit so well. You know, I would give them all kinds of marks.
Yeah,
comments. And, you know, then we do type, movement, the way they carry themselves, what I think is very important. And then the way of jumping. And in that jumping, you know, we look for technique, we look for scope, and we see this, the lightness. But okay, that lightness you see also back in the movement.
Well, that's, I was just going to go back to the movement. And would you discuss or describe a little bit more, in, when you're saying the way they carry themselves? What would you like to see?
That they carry themselves, yeah. And how should I explain that? You know, sometimes you see a horse trotting, and then you see, yeah, he has a big step and he moves well, but he doesn't carry himself. It's like a ballerina. A ballerina carries himself. You know, they go on their toes. Is it toes?
Yeah, toes. Yeah.
And you know, and that's the same with a horse. You know, they have a lightness and elegance. And they can carry themselves, yeah.
You know, and earlier you mentioned, I think, that you wanted them to see them carry themselves in an uphill manner.
Yeah, an uphill manner, what you like to see in a foal. You know, how do you judge a foal? But, you know, and how a stallion breathes. But you like when they trot away that they use that hind end, you know, straight away. Because, you know, if they
leave it behind.
leaving these legs behind, you know, by the age of 5, you're still working to get it underneath. Because as you know, for a dressage or for a jumper, the bills have to be different, but the principle is the same, you know. You have to be able to sit and push off. And that's what you can see a lot from the using, how they use the hind leg. It can be a straight hind leg, it can be a little bit of curve. You know, it's not written in the books that it's this or that. But the way they carry them, the way they use it, there you can see a lot.
And then, so you keep them in for a week. And earlier did you say you assess, was it 3 times in a week, but you leave a day apart? Was that
yes,
it?
That's correct. Yep.
Okay. And I thought what was interesting, and I've seen you mention it before, when you bring them back at 2.5 or 3.
3.5. I don't jump them in between so much.
And also what's important, from a cost perspective, a lot of the time you send them away to be raised, isn't that?
Yeah, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, because, okay, we're getting a little bit back to it, like we like to have it more home, because the trade in the young horses is more active than it ever was. But from the other hand, you have to be realistic. You never, almost never can have so much grassland around your farm that you can keep all these numbers here. And actually, I have very good people up north in Holstein and in the north of Holland who are taking care of these horses. So I keep it like that. And then when they come back 3 rising 4 before they get ridden, then we jump them again. And then we make x-rays before we put a saddle on. We like to know the status of the horses. And the nice thing is that 90% or more jumps exactly the same like the day it left as a yearling. And, you know, that makes it totally adjustable that you jump them as yearlings and make the decisions.
Yeah. And potentially save yourself a lot of money in raising.
Yeah, and disappointments for sure. And, you see, and that's, I have to say also to you, and that's, I think, in general, when I started this 20 years ago, I was happy if 50% jumped or 40% jumped the way I would like to see it. But you know, by this breeding is getting much better. Like, and you know the dam lines, you learn so much. Nowadays, we are between 80 and 90% what is word keeping, and I mean word keeping is that they bring a profit by the age of 5, and that could be a small profit or a bigger profit, but at least they're word keeping. So, I came from 50%, but we are up now to 80-90%. Because we select more on the mares, we are stronger with the stallions. And that's also something you learned over the years, because, like you say, it costs you too much money if they're not worth keeping till that age.
Yeah, I can't remember where I saw it before, but you mentioned at some point that if you don't think that horse is going to be worth the minimum of, say, 25,000, does it? I can't remember if it was a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old, then it needs to go straight away.
That's correct.
Because it's not going to leave any profit.
That's correct. Okay, the cost of raising is getting a little bit more expensive, so you have to be a little bit careful. The foals are getting more expensive. But no, there was a certain number, and I still have a certain number that I say, hey, listen, this has to come back. And you know, when they go under tech, we say the first year they have to be growing the horse for 10,000. Otherwise, we don't put tech on them, we better sell. And as older they get, the grow has to be bigger, because the expenses are getting bigger.
Of course, yeah. Do you notice, are the special ones each year usually coming from the same breeders, or the same mares, or the same lines, or is it different every year?
No, but I think that's with everybody. You have certain lines that are stronger than the other. It's not always the same mother who brings the best ones, but yeah, for sure there's certain lines who are stronger. And if you see, go back to breeding, I started so many lines, but I know also back to 5-6 lines, where it's set over the years, they give me the most guarantee. But that's with everybody who does breeding or who breeds, sees certain levels getting better and some levels getting weaker. It's not always the same combination who brings the best horse, but for sure you always get out to the dam lines. And I spoke the other day with Egbert Skep, who's does almost the same than me. Mm-hmm. And what we see and that's what I told you earlier, to stay close to home, is that we breed the best horse ourselves. And that is not that we have the most knowledge, but you know the most of your own horses. And you know to make the best
combination,
because you know your mother the best. And if I go to an auction, and I have to buy at auctions, and everybody has to buy at auctions, but the pedigree can be so good, but if I don't know the last two mares personally, that makes it more complicated, And then you can have bigger disappointments.
And I think what's more challenging now at a lot of auctions is a lot of the time when you see the foal now, you're seeing it with the recipient mare. So you can't even make the assessment.
Oh, absolutely.
That's quite, even as a breeder, to try and educate myself, that's something that I'm disappointed when I go to some of the bigger auctions because maybe they're from the better pedigrees. They're an embryo transfer.
But even I tell you, it's a very good sense you make there. We do this foal auction also every year. We have 100 foals, and that's always interesting, these selection days. But sometimes there comes a mother, and then I'm not talking about surrogate mothers, but real mother. And the pedigree is so good. But then you see the mother, and then you as judges, you say to each other, would you buy a foal out of that mare? Mm-hmm. Even if the foal is half decent, but in your mind it's going to grow like the mother. And I totally agree with you. Is all these auctions are so important that you see the dam on the side of it.
Yeah. With your selections, then, if we just focus not necessarily on what horses go forward into the sport as such, but even from your breeding selections, because here, you're dealing between your son and your nephew. You have sports stables to fill. You have your Dutch sport horse auction. You have your Limburg foal auction. There's so many different parts of the business that these horses are going to go out to. But also, you need to select mares for your own breeding program. And you need to select the future stallions for your stallion program. So, from those 80 to 100 foals each year, how many do you end up with that are good enough to go for maybe a stallion approval, and how many are good enough to enter your breeding program, be it permanently or for embryo transfer?
That's a good point. Stallion, that's a gift by God, I always say. You know, there were, I don't know, 100 stallions on the stallion show, and there is, to be honest, in these days, there is not one bad pedigree anymore. So on pedigrees, you know, they could be all stallions. But if you see the complete horse, you know, like you see a sire, yeah, that's a good word, you see the sire, you see this jump you like, you see the movement you like, that's very rare and that's very difficult. That's also why stallions, good stallions, stay that long popular, because it's not so easy to replace them.
Yeah.
There are stallions from 30 years where we still sing out the best stallions. That's a damn long time. A stallion is a gift by God, I always say. Then everything comes together. And once in a while you see that in a horse. So if you see, and that's very open, I run these 100 foals every year. I come every year on the stallion show with 3-4 at the most. So that tells you how critical I am to a stallion. Now you ask me how many of these 3-4 became really good producers or became famous stallions. That's even small.
But your success rate, actually, you might be very... Say you have 100 foals, even if we say, to make it easy, 50-50, colts, fillies.
Yeah.
You're hoping to have maybe 3 or 4 to go to the approvals. But your selection must be very good, because your strike rate from what you put to the approvals this week, you got a very good result.
Yeah. No, but the quality is getting better. I have to say, I think I was blessed this year. I had a very good group. But I tell you, there are also some good jumpers, and they're also with good pedigrees. Colts would go easily to these stallion selections and make it, also from the groups I had this year. But you know, I don't see myself in there as a sire, and that's something you it's hard to explain that, but that's what you have to see in a horse.
Yeah.
And you know, these days it's so difficult for young stallions to get a number of mares. And even I had stallions who were approved in my program who didn't get enough mares. But for the marketing, not for the market to sell them, they're better off to be gelded. So I gelded also a couple of approved stallions. And you know, you should not dream and wait, oh, the people, they don't follow me. No, that's a fact. You know, I had a very good example. I had a stallion and he did every year 10 mares. And you know, to my belief, he should have done more mares. But if the world tells you they're not going to use him, what is the sense of leaving him a stallion? Like the amateur market, the professional market, there's no rider in the world who comes to you that he says, oh, I prefer stallions above geldings and mares. Because we know all the stallions, they have a little bit of an attitude, they're stronger in their mind. So also there we think if the people don't use them enough, we go back to gelding, and you know, and it's better for the market later where we have to sell them.
Yeah.
And a lot of these 2 and 3 years old, they are extraordinary jumpers, but you know, the picture is not complete, and then you geld them.
Yeah. With your mares then, rough approximately, how many of those 3-year old mares do you usually breed from?
10. But that's also not a fixed number. Mm. That can be 7 one year, that can be 6 one year, or 5, but it can also be 12. But it's always around the 10. Mares who have a good pedigree, and then again have that lightness and the jump, the ability, everything they want. They did it very serious that I went to the keurings of the KWPN, but I felt I didn't feel comfortable. I had 7 mares out of that program from that 1 year, and you know, the local here, they were 1 to number 7. They were the mares out of my program. Okay. And I didn't feel comfortable. But because I have 100 horses to show, you know, and this local breeder has 1 or 2 to pick out. So I think that was not fair. But that tells you how strong my damn side is getting.
Yes.
And I think that's very important.
And in the past, you would have covered those 3-year-olds, you would have taken a foal and then produced them. Now, are you letting them carry one, or is it all embryo transfer?
90% embryo transfer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Through all your various different businesses, through the auctions, through buying horses, through the stallion business here, you come in contact with a lot of breeders, not just in your area, but throughout the world. What questions do you think breeders should be asking themselves more of? Do they ask enough questions of themselves? And what are the questions that they should be asking themselves more?
How good is my mare? They do that more and more. You know, there are two types of breeders. Huh? For me, the breeding became so important for my business. In the old days, when I went to horse show, I would scout. I had good shows in the old days where I got home in a week and then I bought 10 horses. But I had it was very normal for me when I came home from a horse show that I bought 1 or 2 horses. And that became less and less. First, the competition was bigger. There were more people fishing out of the same pound. Yeah. And the competition got bigger, so the prices went up. And the people got a different... the internet changed the world. And like people, they had their own contacts. They didn't need these traders so much to get these horses sold, because they made their own contacts, and that's good. Some people who bred a horse, they even knew better what the horse was doing in America than me, because they Googled it and they found it, and they make also their own contacts. So for me, it became more and more difficult for buying the horses. But we had this huge operation, and I would love to I would love to continue that business. So I my breeding program, and more or less, and that's where I learned the most of it, became was getting more and more important for the success of Stal Hendrix. Because if I did the wrong combination, if I used the wrong stallions, if I used the wrong mares, that would lay me back in my selling point on the auction and everything. We still scout, and don't take me wrong, scouting is still a very important asset of our business, but it becomes more and more difficult to buy out of that market. So for me, it's very important that that product, what I produce, is be able for my business, for either that young auction is for the sport, for the children, or for to resell later on for the bigger sport, 2-star or bigger. There are also certain breeders, they breed more or less very commercial. And I'm not too, I don't belong to that group, because I love to use a young stallion. But if I have this black type mare and I use it with Chaco Blue, for sure there are 4 or 5 auctions who call me and they say, hey, listen, could you bring it? I have this good young stallion called Lambada Sheikh, and I have 15 yearlings of him now, and probably I get 10 horses of him. It's a little bit risky, I know, because he doesn't tell me everything. But no auction in Europe is going to call me and say, Paul, would you bring a Lambada Sheikh? So there are two sides. And what I'm missing a little bit with that other party, what I see also by videos and what I see also by pictures, that they forget a little bit about the model. And it's just pedigree on pedigree on pedigree, and forget about the horse. And that's a big warning for me, for most of the breeders. Keep looking to that horse, because everything you miss in conformation, you have to fix that riding, or that goes with soundness. But okay, probably you say now to me, yeah, but these people sell us false. And that's exactly where it goes a little bit wrong. You know, for me, it's important that the whole package is correct. Otherwise, you know, I will hurt myself down the road. But, you know, if you're just seeing of selling false, it's a different. But a lot of people forget about the model then and say, yeah, but here, five-star stallion, five-star mare, blah, blah, blah. And that's a little bit my concern for the future.
And I would really share that concern, because what is breeding? Breeding is taking two animals, combining two animals to try and create perfection, to try and create a better generation. And if you're trying to breed any other animals, say in the world of agriculture, it's to try and progress, it's to produce a better animal than the two animals that you're starting with. By combining them, complementing strengths and weaknesses. But the way that a lot of breeding is going, when you stand back and you think, what has this to do with breeding anymore? So I definitely share your concern.
We're on the same page, exactly.
Something that you mentioned, you made a lot of good points when you were speaking in Ireland. I hope everybody was listening. But if they're not, they have an opportunity to listen again. Was something that I feel in Ireland we still hold on to a lot is when you visited the Dublin Horse Show, for an example, or I'm sure in the years since you've been back, the loose jumping competition attracts a lot of people, and we have loose jumping competitions around the country that people are very interested in. But I thought it was interesting that you made the point that it should, for you, loose jumping competitions should be a thing of the past and only used as a method of selection at home. Would you mind talking a little bit about kind of your feelings behind that, or why you think that should be the case?
Yeah, I'm very clear, and I'm glad that I said it 9 years ago. It was 2013,
yeah.
You said? Yeah. So I'm glad I said it 9 years ago, and I'm even way stronger about it. There are certain, you know, loose jumping for selection at home for yourself, that's fantastic. But loose jumping became too much of a contest. And, you know, and then people... try to find, how should I say that, proper
tricks
to be successful and be the winner of the day. And that can be not the idea behind loose jumping, because loose jumping is for that we can see the ability of a horse, and you know, it gives you an indication of the future of the horse. Now, the same on stallion shows, and we're getting to the point, and I'm glad that I said it 9 years ago exactly the same. I think in 10 years from now, we're not jumping loose anymore on stallion approvals, because we all paid our penalties. Maybe that's not good English, but we all made our mistakes by choosing the stallions on loose jumping. Mm-hmm. Huh? And as you know, a lot of tricks can be done. And it became so professional that you not even hardly can look through it, even for the judges, but also for the buyers. So what I say, and that it is very important how a horse jumps under tack, you know, how he jumps in the ring, and go from there. And that has to be the future.
Yes.
And I believe totally in that. And I think we're getting close to it, and we have to be also careful with the welfare of the horse, because a lot of these horses are under three and they jump way too big, loose, and we see all these videos coming by, you know, from these horses who are flying, and that we say this is not real, this is not reality, this is impossible. So I would say for getting better. Our breeding still better is select them when they're jumping in the ring, and we don't make as many mistakes, and we don't get fooled as much as we got fooled in the past. So from that part, I'm exactly on the same point, even way stronger than back then. And it, you know, I was hoping that we were already further in these 9 years than we are now. But special now with COVID, you know that the selling of videos became way more important than in the old days, where people were traveling more to see horses and things like that. You know, and now you see these videos coming by that horses jump crazy big. And you know, they try to attach to people by the views. So I'm very strong about it. We should go away from it. And we should train these horses at home. Also to, our future stars, we should pick them in the horse shows and not with the loose jump.
Yes, because it's what's important, I think you mentioned it at the start of the conversation, you liked to buy the horses in the ring because that's where you were selling them for. Exactly. Then why are we selecting them loose jumping when we're trying to breed for undersaddle?
You know, loose jumping should be a selection thing for yourself, but should be not a contest, and it became a contest.
A lot of your business activities, the auction where you buy horses, your stallion business, really everything seems to have an element to it where you are trying to support and strengthen the local area here. And when we took a drive around, it's amazing to see what this area has become in the time that you've been involved in horses. I think in Ireland, we're still missing, we have great producers, but we're still missing some of the infrastructure that we really, really need. And I think some people that travel to Holland will be very familiar with the likes of, say, Peelbergen or Centaur Park in Belgium, yeah. But for the people who maybe are not that aware, you would have been one of the initial people involved in the creation of Peelbergen. Would you mind just giving a quick overview on how that came to be and then what that has done for the area to bring it to the next level? Yeah.
Okay, you know, that's a plus we had. Is we are in the south of Holland, and in the old days, you know, it was not the best area from the Netherlands to be in business, because, you know, mainly big businesses and the big companies were in the west of Holland, near Amsterdam, Rotterdam, the big cities. But with the open borders, it became a very interesting area. You know, we are 3 hours away from Frankfurt, we are 40 minutes away from Düsseldorf, we are an hour and a half away from Brussels. So this area became very global for that reason. The other reason was we had a good facility in Holland, Roggel, but the guy could sell it to a developer, and we knew it was going to be closed. So on one point we were discussing that we had to have a replacement, and we knew that we had to do something for the area to keep this area strong. Otherwise, we were afraid that the business would go to Belgium or somewhere else, you know, where these facilities were. Not that these facilities are around big in numbers, but there were some facilities who became very popular.
Yeah.
And then the best point, we were looking for money to do that, and I felt straight away, and I was not the only, but in the conversations, you know, to get the city and the province behind us to raise money, we had to bring also money up from the people out of the business. And I have to say, I think our big success was that we had a very large group of young people who saw the benefit of it. Even it was Leon Tyson, Van Ast, Piet Raymakers, Van der Vleuten. Everybody saw that it would be a big advantage if we would have a place, and they were all hungry to grow and to be a part of that. And the best part of the Peelbergen was that 20-30 people who were active in training and in sport, they all came up with money and said, we do this for the sport and for our area. And we were not, probably nobody asked, what's my return in 3 years? Probably nobody asked. Our return was that it was there and that it would make our business stronger. Yes. And exactly that's what happened. But it even happened way bigger than we all expected. If you go now to the area, you know, we passed Hendrik van Eckermann's place, that's Swedish. He's married to a Swiss lady. There are Brazilians in this area. There are South Africans in this area.
The Turkish.
Turkish, yeah, they're next door. They all came to this area. First of all, it is a very good located area in Europe. But other than that, the sport is here. Yeah. And I made myself always strong for the area to make it. I always make myself hard for the area to make it as strong as possible. And I always said to the people who were breeding, I said, breeding mostly happens where the sport is. Before people get interesting, they get showed the best horses, they get showed the best riders. And in the old days, it was Ireland. You remember that I came to Ireland? You had great riders, you had great horses back then. Then, a little bit later, it was Hanover. There were Hermann Schriede, Hartwig Stinken. Okay, Schockermullers came from Oldenburg, but a little sideways of that. But there was the sport. Then it went to France, because we had Navet, Normandy. We had these great breeders there, and all these sons, they started to ride, and they were great talents. It was Navet, Levallois, all these good guys, you know. It was really big there. And then later it came to Holland and Belgium. You know, because sport became bigger here and people start to breed, start to think more about breeding, because they all wanted that best horse to have going. And that's why I really was pushing to get this done with the Peelbergen. But I'm also pushing on the other side to get the breeders better materials, you know. And yeah, that's what I always said, you know, every rider you ask as a breeder, you know, he's glad to help you with a comment, you know, about his mare or about his offspring. And, you know, yeah, you try to reach for the best.
Yeah, but I think it's, from the outside looking in, I think it's incredible what has been achieved
in this area.
I think it should be inspirational for other areas. Similarly with Ireland, I think that we could benefit so much from a facility or from initiatives like that. It's something I'd love to.
Yeah.
And we have some good places and some good people trying to do their best, but a facility like that, that you could bring in people for training or bring in high-end clients, that I think would just change everything.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting as horse producers, this is a conversation that we had a few months ago. In Ireland, I see it a lot. Maybe it happens similarly in other countries as well. So you, for instance, in your case, if you have approximately 100 foals, but you've bred 30 or less, that means you've bought 70 of them. And what I really, really like is you only put your prefix on a horse if you bought it.
We talked about that.
And for me, I think that's great, because sometimes, yeah, a lot in Ireland, a producer, I understand they've put their money, they've invested, but they might either put their prefix on a horse that they didn't breed, maybe they even had it for a day, and next thing,
it has a
prefix on. For those that obviously weren't there for that conversation, why do you only put HX on the horses that you breed? And then will you talk a little bit about when you're selling a horse, what you want to happen?
Actually, I made up a contract when you came in. It was a horse I sold to the States, and I made a bill of sale. And actually, I made it there that the horse should keep his name, and that they always have to be aware if they sell it on, that they have to pass that I didn't go so far that I put a fine on it, but yeah, no, I want to keep that horse name. You know, that's the power of a breeder, And and I totally agree with you. It's a bit stealing or going away with the, you know, why should I call a horse HX if I had it for 2 hours? You know, you can see it as a marketing thing, but I see it maybe more from a breeder point of view that, you know, you should leave the credits to the people who produced it. And I like to see that with my good horses I produce. And I also never will take the initials away from a horse what I get from somebody else, because I know what it takes to breed a good horse, and you have to give them the benefit for that. I'm on the same page as you. For commercial reasons, I can see it. You know, maybe in the future we can combine, get together, and you know, make clear rules there. Clear rules that everybody stays with that a little bit more. That would be better, and that would do more right to the breeders. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
Over the last 40 years, you have sold quite a considerable amount of horses. And sometimes, as recently as this week, there was Leonie J. And he was an example of one that you saw as a six-year-old and you knew there was something special there. But what I'm wondering is, of all the horses that you've sold in the past 40 or so years, what horses have most exceeded your expectations, that they turned out to be something far greater than you even thought they were going to be?
Oh, you know, if a good horse dealer, you always have high high expectations, otherwise you can't sell them. No, for sure, Leonie J, you know, he was... You know, you don't... I was thrilled when I found that horse. It was like I wrote in that article. You know, the horse... You saw something in a horse that you hardly see, and that took my eye. And I think also that was my experience, that I know that I didn't walk into a horse that often. So, are there more horses that you say who live above the expectations you have? No, that's not really. But I know as well that these good horses have to come to the best riders. And that's a part of the success of a horse. With all respect, but Leonie J, not with Martin Fuchs, you know, you can also ruin a horse or take the edge away from a horse like that. And, what were our success stories? That were Big Ben to Ian Miller. Mm-hmm. That were the good horses to Laura Kraut.
Yeah.
We had success, a horse who came to John Whittaker and several. And as we know, the rider, for that last little bit, the rider is so important. So I was so happy that Leonie J came to a rider from that level, like Martin Fuchs. And I think you should ask the opposite. Were you disappointed in some horses? Yeah, I was not disappointed in the horses, but on the matches I made.
Well, I thought that was interesting. In the World of Show Jumping article with Leonie J, was that yourself and Emile, you bought the horse, and yourself and Emile felt this is a horse for Martin Fuchs. But when Martin Fuchs watched the video, he didn't see what the excitement was about until he sat on the horse, and then he knew this was something special. Mm. So that shows a very interesting or a very good skill set for yourself and Emile, that you saw the horse and thought this suits Martin Fuchs. Martin looks at the videos and isn't blown away, but then sits on the horse and then completely agrees.
I think that I could judge it early very well, you know, but don't forget, I do viewing horses for more than 40 years, so I train my eye on that, that's something I picked up.
A lot of people, though, are dealing in horses for 40 years and can't do it. So I think even Laura Kraut somewhere said it as well. Like before, when Laura Kraut bought Liberty, I think she had been here a few weeks previous with a client, but she had never bought a horse in Europe before she came with that client. She came back a few weeks later, bought Liberty, But I think she commented something similar about, like, you just know when a horse will suit her.
Yeah. No, you know, it was even another horse of Laura. Anthem was a fantastic horse for Laura. And Anthem, I knew from the beginning it would be a perfect match with Laura. And I had some people trying the horse, and Laura tried the horse. And probably you go back to this story. And Laura tried Anthem, and at the time Anthem was an expensive horse. And I said to Laura, I'd love you to have this horse. And she says, oh, Paul, I have no sponsors. I had interest in the meantime in the horse, but I now we're talking about a couple of months' time. And I kept it always slow. And I spoke every week with Laura, and Laura either said to me, I have no people who are going to buy the horse, or I ask Laura, how is the situation? But I always said to her, I wait, because I want this horse to be with you. And I never forget, it was a Sunday night here. She calls and says, Paul, believe it or not, I just won with Liberty the big Grand Prix in the WEF. And you know what, I have a group of people who are going to buy Anthem, because they all get excited because I won the Grand Prix. And this was probably 6 weeks to 2 months later after she tried it. And I was so happy that I kept the horse. And she, you know, if you ask her tomorrow to her top five favorite horses, I think for sure Anthem was one of them.
But also, if you look to her top even 5 to 10 famous horses, quite a few of them have come from you, because did Cedric come from you also?
Yeah. Emil found Cedric with her, yeah. Yeah. It's no, and Liberty and Anthem.
And at Liberty did the Olympics. And
Yeah. No, exactly. You know, but some people you have a match and you know it works like that, and you know, and that's good. And Laura and Ian Miller the same. I think Ian rode 10 Olympics and I think 7 or 8 with horses from us. So that's fantastic. That's incredible. That, you know, that's a lifetime. Fantastic. Yeah, fantastic.
That leads nicely onto my next question. My second last question was, I was curious with all the businesses, when I look at what you do, or when I see you involved in something or speaking at an event, everything you do, you seem to do very well. But how do you measure or define success in your business? Are you deliberate in doing reviews or an annual review? Or what does success mean to you?
What does success mean to me? Success is continue my business and stay on the same level. That's success for me. You know, I would hate if they said, oh, Hendricks fall back, you know. Or, you know how difficult it is in this business to stay up for 40 years and have on a certain level success. So that's for me very important. I like to be known as a horseman. And, you know, people, they have to... my word has to be trustful to them. You know what I'm saying? If I tell you this is the right horse for you, that has to be true. I cannot give you guarantee with horses, but at least if I give you an advice, it has to be realistic and close to the truth. You know what I'm saying? It should be not that is the opposite from what I told you it is. You know, so at least that's a part of success what I like. You know, the Fuchs story you heard earlier on, I think that was nice. You know, Emil and I were both, we knew the horse would fit to a super rider, and Martin Fuchs came by, and it is like we said. And, you know, injuries and everything can blow things away, you know. It can come overnight, you know, so that is the other part. But I don't think I gave you the good answer on success, but...
Well, I was interested that you said on the same level, because I don't know if you're someone that likes to stay on the same level. I think you like to keep going up a level. If you look at the progression of... what you have done, So you said in breeding at the beginning, maybe you were getting 50% of the good ones were good at three. Now you're up at 90%. If you look at your stallions, you brought three to the, you brought three to Ermelo this week. They got approved. You look at the Dutch sport horse sales and the success that it's gone
to. Yeah, but I think that's more answer the questions at the time. I was talking with my wife 39 years ago. I thought it was 40. I had two stallions at the stallion show, Wolfgang and Verestosnes. And the one was champion and the one was approved. And I was very young at the time, you know, when I started with these stallions. And, you know, I do it 40 years later, but in another setting. And that's maybe where you want to go is you have to go with the time. It would be not good if they would call me old-fashioned. And a lot of horse people, it is a general for all the businesses, that's so important that you get the new generation, that you not live up to the time where you live at. You know what I'm saying? I'm proud of the success I had 20 years ago, but I cannot live from it anymore. You know, I have to live up to these days, and you know, I have to be able to see even 10 years from now. You know, and that I think with the Pilbaring we saw that right, with the breeding we saw that the right direction, and with the sport we saw that the right direction. But yeah, that's maybe the biggest part of success, that you be able to look forward in life. And if you start to look backwards in life to be and live on that success, that's where you go down the hill.
And even you think with all the different businesses that you're involved in, you think, right, even something we haven't mentioned is you also run a show here with the Peel and Mass, and you think, right, you have all the businesses that you could have, and then your daughter Janu goes and starts another new business with yeah. Barnbridge. Yeah. And I was actually hoping she'd stay in the room so she could talk about it and mention it herself. Yeah. But even that, just for anyone that's not aware of it, now rather than looking through all the different auctions and trying to see what's available, Paul's daughter Janu has, with a business partner, has built barnbridge.com, where you can see a lot of auctions in one place, but also a lot of the listings, and you can set notifications. Isn't that correct? Where
yeah.
If you were interested in whatever Cornet Oblenskys are, that you can create listings or broodmares. And I think it's nice to see the entrepreneurialism has been inherited.
It's in the genes, and it will improve as well. Yeah.
Exactly.
So maybe success is improving.
Yeah, and shows the importance of breeding.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
My last question is the question that I finish all of the interviews with, is what advice would you offer to a young breeder or to someone at the start of their breeding program? But I'm going to add an extra element for you.
Yeah.
So first it's the advice for a young breeder, but then I'm also curious to know, if you were talking to a young person that was at the start of their dealing or trading business, how would you advise them?
Stay close to yourself. Don't try to copy other people. Do that where you believe in. Make sure you be straight in your quotes and in your advices. Like we talked earlier, that's what what I would give to young people. And other than that, for a young breeder, don't overdo yourself. Start with a good basic. Can be a foal, can be a mare. What you find, it's easier for me to talk maybe from the heart of Europe here in Holland to find a broodmare than if you live somewhere else. Start with a good dam line. That's the start, but that's a very common thing. That's, you know, that's maybe too easy to say it. Use the good stallions. It depends all a little bit what are your chances might be. I have to say, to start breeding, it's not a matter of buying a very expensive mare. Listen well, look well around, and then you get your chances for a fair amount to start breeding and be successful in breeding.
I think that's a very good point, because how much you pay is not a reflection on what you've, on the quality of the mare that you've bought.
No, exactly.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?